Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Welcome back to another episode of The Lobbying Show. Today, we come to you again from Washington, D.C., from the Denton's headquarters at 19th and K. And today, we sit down with Marcel Halma. Marcel is the Global Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations for Nurion. We're going to ask him about Nurion, the company. It's a Dutch multinational company. So we are the lobbying show is going international today. International. We're going all the way to Europe. They are in many countries. They have over 10,000 employees, about $5 billion in revenue. It's a big company. They're based in Amsterdam. And Marcel is obviously based there, or not obviously, but he is. He's based in the Netherlands, and he is in the DC in the United States for business. Marcel, welcome to the show, and welcome to the U.S. What brings you here?
Thank you, Jim. It's great being here. There are two reasons for me to come to the United States this time. One is that I met my team in Chicago, where we have our regional North America headquarters. So I was there last Friday talking with the team. And now this week I'm meeting here for the ACC board, the American Chemistry Council, which is one of the bigger associations. They have the board meeting. So I'm here with our president for the Americas. And I'm meeting some of our consultants that we're using here for the U.S. and for China. One of our suppliers, we have a tech firm that assists us in government affairs.
So you belong to that association here in the U.S. And,
yeah.
And is that the group that you use when you have issues at state capitals or in D.C. To do your lobbying on your behalf?
Yeah. The ACC is the American Chemistry Council, one of the bigger and stronger associations here in Washington. Chemicals in itself is a big industry. It's a revenue of almost $500 billion dollars in the U.S. It has almost 500,000 jobs here in the U.S. and indirectly even supports another 4 million. It's 25% of GDP, and it has about 10% of U.S. exports. So it's a huge
10% of U.S. exports?
Yeah. So we're a huge industry, and ACC is representing all the companies in that industry for the best interest that that we need to defend, and also to proactively lobby for opportunities.
Let's back up a little bit. Tell us about the name of the company, Nurion. Where does that come from?
So Nurion is a new name. We were split off from the big ExxonMobil group, a big industrial group in the Netherlands, about 1.5 years ago after a fierce takeover fight by PPG, an American paint company, who tried to acquire the whole ExxonMobil.
For our
company.
Listeners, sorry to interrupt you, Marcel. PPG, what does that stand for?
Pittsburgh Plate Glass.
Okay.
It's a big, big American paint and coatings company,
yes.
And they wanted to acquire ExxonMobil. We managed, also with a lot of help from government, from my government affairs team, to hold that off. But part of that was a strategic decision to split the company. So the chemicals part was sold to the Carlyle Group here in Washington, and we had to make a new name. And that name became Nurion. If you have to invent a name, of course, there are many options, but what to choose. So we went to our clients and customers and asked them, what do you look for in a name? And they all said to us, you know, you're a 400-year-old company. You're forward-looking, you're strong, you have a very good record. So make something that reflects both the heritage and is forward-looking. Then you go into your company history, and we came with the name of Nuri and van der Lande, who are two Dutch chemists from the 19th century. They made an additive, a peroxide, which you still use probably everyone every day because it's in bread. It makes the bread lighter.
Peroxides in bread?
Yep.
Doesn't sound very appetizing, but okay.
Well, there are a lot of chemicals in everything that you use, and even your body is one big chemical factory, I can tell you.
Yep.
But so we went into the name. We found that name, Nuri and van der Lande, took the Nuri part of it, added the on, forward-looking, you know, Nuri on, makes it strong.
Ah.
But then, of course, you have a name, and then you need to check, what does it mean? not only in Dutch, but also in English, in Spanish, in Farsi, and whatever language. And also, how do you read it from left to right and right to left? Because you don't want to end up with a name which means something funny or something nasty.
And does it mean anything in any language?
No, as far as we know, it's safe. So, and then we had a special N that we used. That was the N of the former Nobel company. One of the founders of our company is Alfred Nobel, who is also the name behind the Nobel Prizes, as you know. And there are not that many. There's no company elsewhere in the world that can use that name. But that N that we use in the beginning, the marker of our name, was a letter that got in disuse when the Dutch Exo and Nobel in the 1990s merged. If two companies merge, you need kind of something new that doesn't resemble one or two. So we use that N back. So there's a lot of heritage, both from the Nobel part as from the Nouri part in it. And that's what the new name is.
And so you are now, so the chemical part of the company and the paints and coatings split, and definitely, you are now the chemical company and owned by the Carlyle Group here in D.C.
Absolutely.
Which is convenient for when you come here for government relation type work for you. What are some of the challenges or issues that you're facing
here in the U.S.? Well, one of the issues that we face is rail policy. We're one of the bigger shippers in the U.S., and there's quite a lot going on in terms of tariffs of rail, but also on all kinds of requirements for rail tank cars, identifications, etc. Then, of course, there are some substances which are under attack, which are under consideration. There's a whole environmental agenda that plays. We are also working on making our energy use more renewable, making it more efficient. We're in a good position as Nouri-on. We are one of the more sustainable companies. As part of the Exxon Mobil Group, led the Dow Jones Sustainability Rankings. Almost half of our energy use is already coming from renewable sources globally, which is huge because energy, chemistry is a very energy intensive business. So it's a lot of effort, but it's good work. And so,
do you know where you get most of your renewable energy? I mean, is it offshore wind, solar? Do you know what?
It's a mix. Wind is not generating. Solar is not generating enough power. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly from wind. In countries like Sweden, we use a lot of hydropower because it's available there. It depends a little bit, of course, what's available in the market. And also, don't forget about energy efficiency. The less energy you use, of course, the better. And now we're developing green hydrogen. We're a huge chlorine producer, in particular in Europe. And it was for long a byproduct, but with electrolyzers, you split off the hydrogen. And using wind energy with an electrolyzer, produce green hydrogen. And that's really the future.
Great. And how often do you get to the United States?
I come here a couple of times a year. I usually start a visit in Chicago, where we have our regional headquarters, and meet with the business leaders there and the different teams, regulatory teams, and discuss with them the issues we have, align with them, coordinate with them. And then it depends whether I come to Washington, if there are ACC meetings here or other parts in the country.
And you had said earlier that the government relations team helped when you were fighting off the hostile takeover.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the government relations team helped out?
Definitely. If you enter in such a fight, of course, first you get the lawyers in. But it's also important that you raise a lot of public support for your company. Now, we had the advantage when they did the takeover fight that 3 weeks before that, Unilever, another Dutch big giant, had been under takeover fight from another company. So politicians were already alerted. Then you should know that this takeover happened in the last weeks of the general election in the Netherlands. Which, if I had been the advisor of that company, would have said, you know, wait till the elections are over. But if the politicians are on the campaign trail, it's not a good time because they talk a lot. And so that helped us significantly to ignite a lot of public support. And that is what we raised in quite a number of countries. And the basis of that is having a good network. You cannot mobilize NGOs, politics, labor unions in such a short notice if you don't have the relationships.
And now let's talk about your career. You have had quite a career. You have been you were a Dutch diplomat. Tell us about that.
Yeah. When I was a young boy, 12, 13 years old, I read a book from a library about embassies. And then I thought, wow, this is really a great life. This is great work. Always already back at the time when I started reading newspapers, I always started at the international papers. I was very news savvy, and in particular in international news. So when I realized, I wasn't aware of that. I lived in the province. When I realized that diplomacy is a job and that you can work in an embassy and work on international relations, what's in the newspaper, I thought, wow, that's what I want to be. So I went to university, did a minor in economics and graduated in political science and American studies, and then enrolled for the diplomatic career, was hired. So dream came true when I was 25, 26. And since then, I've been a diplomat for about 15 years. Started in The Hague at our ministry head office, and then was sent to Geneva for disarmament work, the verification protocol on the biological weapons treaty. Very dull job, I can tell you. But a year later, we're talking
a dull
20.
Job?
It was dull. It was very technical, and you should know that one of the worst subjects I had in high school was biology and was chemistry. So it's really funny that I ended up
negotiating
in a chemical
negotiating
these treaties, but also ending up in a chemicals company. But so I was sent over there. Yeah, the dice can roll strange ways. So I was sent over there. It was a pretty dull job. It was very technical, but it was very fun operating in an international setting with countries like China, India, Mexico, South Africa, the US, Russia, on working on a treaty. But then 9/11 happened, and the anthrax letters came, and then it was suddenly hot topics. I managed a year later in 2002 to write and initiate a UN resolution on national transfer of arms legislation. That resolution formed later the basis for the UK to make the UN arms treaty. But it was something really, really new at the time. There had been attempts before, but there was never a resolution on arms exports in the UN.
So how did that feel for you to work on something that was ultimately passed as a resolution by the UN? Must have been quite a feeling.
That is quite a feeling, and that is quite an it's a lot of excitement. If you have a new resolution, of course, you never know how it ends up with. If it becomes a consensus resolution and just voted by the hammer, or that there is a contest. So we have had many negotiations with all kinds of delegations and international groups. And we had a pretty good feeling. But then you go into that room, you look at that big screen with the red and the orange and the red dots on it, and then it's just waiting and praying to the good Lord what happens. And it was really funny, that vote, because the whole screen...
The orange being the yes?
Orange is abstention, don't know. Green is yes.
Oh,
and
green.
Red is no.
Yeah. I didn't hear green, yes.
Exactly. And so the whole board turned about green. Up till Vietnam, I remember... pushed the orange button, and then they saw that they were the only one, so they pushed every button they could find. You have about 2 minutes to vote, so it was a bit hilarious in that room. But in the end, they also voted green, and it became a consensus resolution.
Wow!
And stayed ever after.
Is that one of the high point of your career?
It's one of the high points, but it's quite an achievement. If you're just 32 years and you manage that,
it's not bad.
It's great. Yeah.
So how long did you work as a diplomat?
For about 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah. After Geneva, New York, I moved over to the Dutch PERMRAP, the permanent mission, the embassy with the EU in Brussels, where I was head of cabinet for our ambassador there during the EU presidency of 2004. Was sent over to The Hague to set up a staff afterwards in the House of Parliament for EU matters to help them kind of understand EU policymaking, and then became the Director of Communications, and it was my last job in the ministry for Frans Timmermans, who is now the number two in the European Commission.
Wow. Now, backing up, what was your job in Brussels?
In Brussels, I was, that's called the Antici job. I can explain you why they call that the Antici job, but that's basically the head of cabinet of the ambassador. It was about 1975, that the ambassadors got more and more on their plate and decided we need some help out here to prepare our meetings. At the time, Italy held the presidency of the meeting of ambassadors. So the deputy, the assistant to the ambassador was called Antici. It's an Italian name. So that group was called after him, the Antici group.
Got it. Okay.
So there are not a lot of people who know that name and what it means, but that's the background. It's quite an influential group because they prepare the meetings of the ambassadors, but also meetings of ministers.
In Brussels.
Yeah, make sure that everything runs smoothly within an embassy, but also that there is smooth operating of EU decision-making at the ambassador level and ministerial level.
Which job did you enjoy the most or get the most out of?
It's difficult to choose, Jim. I mean, every job brought me great new lessons, new learnings, and there were definitely jobs, of course, I liked less, but there are quite a number of jobs which I learned a lot and that helped me develop and grow in what I'm now.
What's it like working at The Hague? And tell us a little bit about the government in the Netherlands.
Yeah, working in The Hague is working almost in the part of Europe, in the heart of Europe. It's not that far. We have a lot of countries in Europe, as you know, but basically most of them are smaller than the size of U.S. states. It's a two-hour drive from Brussels, but it's a very, very pleasant country to live and work in, the Netherlands. I'm very happy to be a Dutch guy. It's also a UN capital. It's the fourth capital of the UN. It has all the international legal courts of the UN. And more and more other organizations like the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. So it's quite international because of these associations, of organizations. And it was good working and starting your job at the ministry, at the head office. That's where you grow your network. You know, you can be sent off right away to an embassy, but who in the system do you know? It's always good to first learn the system and then go to an embassy abroad or part of your organization and work there.
And it's a constitutional monarchy in the Netherlands?
Yes, we are a constitutional monarchy. We have a king.
Who's the king?
King Willem-Alexander.
Okay.
Married to Queen Maxima. We have a prime minister, Mark Rutte, there for about 10 years now. We are a coalition country, always have been. Governments are always formed by two, three, four parties. It used to be two. In the past, and then I'm talking about the 80s and before, but as we see across the West, the political system splinters, more parties. So now we have a government of four parties, two big ones, two smaller ones. But honestly, you know, if you are a coalition country, if I might call it that, it doesn't matter that much which government you have in power. I think the changes are bigger in countries where you have two political parties, and also for the voter, of course, you have something to choose with two. Mm-hmm. In a coalition government, the parties have to negotiate an agreement, a government agreement, mm-hmm. Which they will execute in the coming years. Mm-hmm. But that also makes that coalitions are more stable and longer term. There is not that much difference if you have a coalition on the center left or on the center right. It's more or less.
The change is slower.
Going the same. But there are changes, and there are
slower.
Different accents. It's slower.
The pendulum doesn't swing quite as much.
Exactly.
Will Brexit impact Nouryon or your responsibilities?
It will, but slightly less than it did when I was still the head of global public affairs for ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil as a group, we had quite a lot of factories and in the offices in the UK. Which, of course, with many employees, has quite a big impact. Nouryon, we have no factories there. We have sales to the UK. But we will manage. At the end of the day, it's a big story. But let's be real. Outside of Europe, there are about 180 countries. We managed to do trade with Norway and Switzerland. So I guess we will manage to do trade with the UK as well. Brexit is over now. That was the easy part. That was the end of the beginning. Let's not forget about that. Don't get too excited about Brexit. The hard part starts now. Negotiating a future deal.
The trade deals
and other relationships in the next 11 months. And it's not only about trade. It's called the trade deals by media and by others, but it's also about product standards, product regulations. It is about defining the future rights of UK citizens living and working in Europe and EU citizens working in the UK. It has a lot more than it than only just setting up the trade deals. And this is a different one. You know, in a trade deal, you try to bring two systems, two countries, two economic blocks together. In this case, the UK has the same legislation, the same standards as we have in the EU. It's kind of splitting. So it's the other way around. And that makes it complicated. But yeah, we'll have to see. Negotiating mandates are now set. I haven't seen a lot coming from the UK again, as we saw in the Brexit as well. I think it's very important that the UK sets its agenda pretty clear and pretty straight. No political statements. The political statements are nice, are good. But we need to see the details on paper to know what's going to happen. It's important because the UK and EU economy are so interwoven that it's as important for the UK as it is for Europe to manage this in an orderly way.
Are there similarities between being a diplomat and government relations?
I think the biggest difference, Jim, honestly, is that as a diplomat, I drank my drinks around in nice and fancy locations, and now it's just a regular bar. No, kidding aside. I don't think there is a lot of difference between the two. Being a diplomat.
What are the similarities?
Well, the similarities are that if you compare it to a multinational, the headquarters is the ministry. And the organizations in the field are called the embassies. What I did as diplomat in both the UN and the EU in my times, in my days, I always say about myself, I'm rather lazy than tired. And I mean with that, people know we always say, what do you mean? You're working quite hard. But what I mean is that I rather think you should do your work up front than wait till it really got into a problem, because the energy, the time, and the money you have to put into it is a lot more. So also as a diplomat, I try to negotiate and bring in as much as the proposals of the Netherlands, the country I represented, into the EU, into the UN system, to make sure that they were on paper. And the more they put on paper and in their proposals, the less I had to negotiate with 28 countries around the table. So that's one. Then, of course, the Dutch government has a government, like a company, has a lot of interests. So you check with other countries like the Brits and the French and the Germans and the Italians and all the others, where they are. And then you can advise back to your organization, you know, this is good, this is in, done, deal, got it. This, forget about it. We're only burning political money here, doesn't work, nobody supports this, forget about it. And the other parts, well, you know, if we give the French this, then we get that in return. The Brits do need this, not important to us, but they need support. If I can support them, they are willing to help me out on that one, et cetera, et cetera. That's basically what you, of course, as a diplomat try to do as well. It's not only, as a lobbyist try to do as well, it's not only just sending the message, but I think an enormous important part of our work in public affairs, government relations, is also bringing society, politics, back into your company, explaining what's happening in the wider world that we operate in, where we are, and what it means for our plans. It's not very good if a company loses a lot of time, energy, and money in issues which could not be win anyway. Principles are good, but solutions are better, I always say.
I like that. But it must also, getting to what's different, as a diplomat, you have leverage, you have more power.
Yeah.
You're part of one of the parties making decisions.
Yeah.
In your current role, you don't have that. You're advocating your
right.
You're articulating your position. You're educating policymakers. Yeah. How do you find that difference? Has that been difficult or just been easy?
It's been easy in the sense that I have been a policymaker as a diplomat, and I was lobbied by all kinds of organizations in that
role.
So
you saw what worked and what didn't.
Well, exactly. I know what worked and what didn't. After I left the diplomatic service, I joined a Dutch industry association in the field of energy for a couple of years. So I've been on that part as well. And now I'm in a big multinational company and see it from that side. Of course, if you are a policymaker, it's different than being a lobbyist. But the challenge for a policymaker is that, you know, you see so many interests coming to you. You have to make a choice of what's relevant there and what to do. But the same is in my case. I mean, you know, if you are a small organization, you have only one interest, it's probably pretty simple. But in a multinational company, as you said, operating in 80 countries around the globe, and having a lot of different businesses. There are even in our own company competing interests. So part of my job is also to make sure that we are aligned on what we want. And if there are competing interests, to make sure that we solve them internally, or at least align on them internally, before we go out there and bring our position. But sometimes, yeah, there are issues that you have to withhold your position because you know, if you go all out on that, you hurt other part of the business. And it's also, you know, and that's the fun of my work as well, being a global public affairs director. I'm here in the base in Amsterdam, but also the Sherpa to my board member here in the ACC. But I do the same job in SAFIC, that's the equivalent of the ACC in Europe. And I can tell you that if I'm here, I see a lot of US bias in how companies, even my own, look at things. And if I'm at Europe, in SAFIC, it's the same companies around the table, but they have a European bias. So it's also, you know, if you talk, for instance, about
all politics
EU,
is local.
It's all politics is local. It's all going back home. But if you, for instance, talk about EU-US trade, it's good to look at both perspectives on both sides of the Atlantic and make sure that you align instead of that you confront. And it has many different angles.
And then you said you go to SAFIC. What SAFIC?
SAFIC is the Council of the European Chemical Industry, so the equivalent of ACC, but then in Europe.
Okay. And how much of your work or time is spent in Europe?
I think in my role, about half of my time is spent now on China. We haven't touched upon China yet, but there are so many issues there. Also, the way government works in China is completely different than as we know it in the West. So that's about half of the
So you're spending a lot of time in China, or on China?
On China.
Yep.
Yeah. And then I think the distribution between Europe and the U.S. is about equal.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you've been involved in the European Association of Communication Directors. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm the chair.
Back to your old job.
I am the chair of the Corporate Citizenship Working Group in the European Association of Communications Directors. Corporate citizenship is, I think, an issue of growing importance. We've had the time of CSR, corporate social responsibility, which is still important, but it's not only about what you do in terms of being sustainable or what you do in terms of your diversity and inclusion. It goes much wider. You see that also in for instance, the Adam and Trust Barometer. I always like the month of January because all these big, huge reports like the WEF, Global Risk Report comes out, and Edelman brings his trust barometer, and it's a wealth of information you found there. But you see in the Edelman Trust Barometer that trust already is a dominant factor for a number of years now and going down, and that at the same companies and NGOs are, of the four institutions they monitor, the other are government and media, are still highly, pretty well trusted. But in public opinion, you see that things change. It's not only about how sustainable are you as a company, But people, the general public, more and more also looks at how you behave as a company. Where do you pay your taxes? How diverse is your board? Mm-hmm. Do you take a stand on societal issues? What role do you play in the communities you operate in? So it goes a little bit further. And that's something that I try for the European Association of Communications Directors to further develop with a group of very interesting people coming from all kinds of big companies and big NGOs in Europe who are a member of that association.
Now, get a little bit on the lighter side, for any of our listeners heading to Europe, yes, or to the Netherlands, where would you suggest where they visit in the Netherlands, or things to do? What do you suggest?
Europe is a great continent with a lot of history. If you come to the Netherlands, you cannot miss my birth town of Amsterdam, the capital, which is great. The canals, huge musea, which is great. But don't forget about the rest of the country. No, I think Europe is, like the United States, has many regions which are all different. So there is so much to explore in Europe.
What are some of your favorite cities?
Well, I love Paris. Paris is great. In particular, the neighborhoods. Barcelona is a great city. I've recently been in Rome again, which is a great city. But I was also very positively surprised 2 years ago when I was in Budapest. I always liked, if I am in cities, to go into neighborhoods, because that's where you really feel the vibration of a city, what a city is like, how the people are living, working there. Much more than, of course, in the touristic hubs where you only meet tourists and don't find the real people. But there are so many great places to see across Europe. But it's different, you know. Being in Italy is completely different than in Sweden, and being in Ireland is different than being in Hungary or Poland. But there is a lot to appreciate in Europe. So I can welcome all your visitors, all your listeners, to come over to Europe.
All right. Well, you heard it. You heard it here. And for any of you heading to the Netherlands, you can reach out to Marcel. He's on LinkedIn. You can find him there. So, Marcel, I have to ask you. You are our second international guest. How did you find the Lobbying Show podcast?
I found it on iTunes, Jim, and I think I was one of your first listeners. I think I stepped in on episode four or five. I was looking at iTunes for, as always, I'm a big podcast fan, for a podcast on government affairs, government relations, public affairs. And you find quite a lot of them. But this one struck me, because most of the podcasts on public affairs, government affairs, are about the how-to. And gives you, you know, a trend analysis for a country, or what's hot and not, or they talk about how to do things and how to operate things. What I like about your show, and that's why I kept on listening to you, is that it is about the person behind the lobbyist, and it gives you a very interesting, in a conversational way, a very interesting peek in how colleagues elsewhere are working on issues, what drives them, what makes them tick. And that's what I really like. My appointment with you is always on Sunday evening when I cook the family dinner, and in the kitchen I close the door and then I put the Lobbying Show on, and while I'm cooking and baking stuff, I listen to all these great interviews that you're doing. So thanks a lot from me also as a listener for having this podcast, and also with going on with it. It's very good.
Well, thank you. Well, you just, you know, that's really what we try to make it all about. We try to make it about the guest, about their experience. And we try to keep the focus on the guest. And so far, it seems to, people seem to be enjoying it. The listenership, the audience is growing. And we get a lot of positive feedback. Our listeners give us ideas about things to do. So it's nice to hear you say that, and we appreciate the positive feedback. So thank you, and keep tuning in on Sunday night. I like that.
Thanks, Jim. Well, you're doing a good job. Thanks,
Marcel. It has been great having you here. Thank you for coming by. For our listeners, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. Remember to subscribe wherever it is that you listen to your podcast, on Google or Spotify or Apple. You can sign up for our Monday morning email, Coffee with the Lobbying Show, at our website, thelobbyingshow.com. And we send that out every Monday with the new show, and it has information in there that you may find interesting. So we hope you have a great week, and see you next Monday.